Piero. Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Aligne lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I'm your host, Nick Toro Jr. For today's episode, I am exploring the idea of permanence versus ephemerality in photography. Oftentimes, we think that the history of photography is all about the idea of a permanent image, fixing a shadow, the idea of capturing on a substrate, usually film or photographic paper, a scene that comes through a lens in a camera. However, if we go back to the origins of the medium of photography, we find that making permanent images was never really a given, and something that many of the early creators of photography struggled with. And so the idea that something is permanently saved as a photograph, even in its earliest days of photography, is somewhat of a fallacy. I recently read a book called The Night Albums, Visibility and the Ephemeral Photograph by Kate Palmer Albers. Kate has written extensively on many different topics in photography, as well as being a teacher of visual culture, contemporary art, media studies, and the history and theory of photography at Whittier College in Los Angeles, California. I found Kate's book, The Night Albums, really intriguing. In it, she explores not only this different history of the early days of photography, but also more contemporary creators and how they've challenged or taken up the whole idea of impermanence and ephemerality in photography. It's a really fascinating book, and I was really excited that Kate agreed to be my guest for today's episode. So that is where we're going, a really interesting discussion of permanence versus the ephemeral. Thanks for joining me today, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Kate Palmer Albers. Well, welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Kate Albers. Is it, do you go by Kate Palmer Albers or Kate Albers or...
I go by both. In print, Kate Palmer Albers, but thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. So, Kate, to start off, just I usually do this with everybody. Can you give a little bit of background about, who you are, what you do, and we can lead up to the book, but just a little bit of your background as far as obviously education, but then also a focus on photography and how all of this kind of came together.
Yeah, I'm a writer and a professor. I'm on the faculty in art and visual studies at Whittier College, which is a small liberal arts college on the sort of eastern side of Los Angeles County. I've been here for about 6 years. I've been in photography since college, essentially, so this sort of the mid-90s. And my background, I guess I started off in the gallery world, and then I had a little bit of time in the museum world. And it seemed really clear to me that I always wanted to be also involved in the world of ideas and writing and thinking about the medium. So I got going in grad school and stayed put as a faculty member. I first joined the University of Arizona faculty. I was there for about 10 years. And this book is my second book that I've that's just written by me. And it came out of a lot of thinking, probably around sort of 2014, 2015 is when I started really thinking about the ideas in the Night Albums.
So you were in Tucson for a while then?
Uh-huh. Yeah. For 10 years.
Yeah, I love Tucson.
A long time. I love it too.
Yeah, it was a great program.
Fantastic to be right across the way from the Center for Creative Photography, of course.
Yeah.
Hugely impactful on my thinking and the way I have a, you know, sort of career long interest in photographic archives and the complexity of them. And so that was really just a true honor and a privilege, really, to be part of that community.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, let's jump into the book. So I actually put it on my Christmas wish list, and my wife got me a copy of it, and I dug into it right away. And what I found interesting about it right from the get-go was the idea that, you know, the ephemeral has been part of photography from its origins, and which to a certain extent, I think, like logically I could get my head around that. But at the same time, I think the expectation of permanence, certainly in photography, I just always made that assumption that that was sort of like, once that was achieved, it was just kind of like a clear path after that. But in the book, it seems like that's not the case. So can we talk a little bit about like the early sort of origins of the medium and how really prominent that whole idea of ephemerality is part of that conversation?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm of course very glad that, you know, the sort of the key takeaway from that idea of the presence of ephemeral photography throughout the history of the medium, that was something that I became fascinated with. And I don't think I would have gotten there without the sort of contemporary ephemerality of photography. Most of my work is in the contemporary era, and I'm not a 19th century specialist, although I love the origins of the medium. I always have, and I always feel sort of a little bit jealous of my friends and colleagues who really focus on 19th century photography. But like you, you know, I had the histories I had read and the narratives I was familiar with, you know, sort of indicated that once the image was fixed, that was it. And we sort of, you know, moved forward. I mean, of course, that's too simple, but, you know, just sort of march of technological progress to some degree. And it was really through conversations with photography conservators that I started, you know, kind of wanting to hear a more complicated version of how fleeting and just how fragile and just how precarious so many of those 19th century photographic processes were. And then, you know, once you start tracing it forward, you know, this, I was writing this also around the same time that there was a kind of renewed attention on color photography and the challenges of having color photographs, especially from the 1970s and the kind of more in what we think of as a sort of the unstable color processes and how that has tracked over the last 30, 40, 50 years. So, but your question was again, sort of about the origins of the medium. I had known certainly that there was a period of experimentation before Fixer, you know, they figured out how to fix the image. I hadn't quite ever thought through how long that had lasted, right? It was, you know, a decade, 15, 20 years, something like that. And then you know, one of the most fun times I had in the research, and this is a very like academic, you know, 19th century nerdy kind of thing, but I was reading the old journals from the 1840s, 1850s, and specifically looking for this group, the Fading Committee, mm-hmm. Who I knew had been, you know, and they're named in lots of books, but I knew that they had been named to figure out this challenge or this problem of photographic instability. And so I started looking for references to their notes of their meetings and just the level of uncertainty and sort of hand-wringing and lack of clarity around what the issue was. You know, was mm-hmm. it the water? Was it the air? Was it, you know, which chemical was it? All of these questions were recorded in the journals, you know, over many, many years. And I really found it kind of exciting, right? It was this sort of felt like a period when certainly they were struggling, but also it felt really alive, you know, like there were so many possibilities for what photography might become. And I was especially excited to find there was only one instance of this I found, but it was sort of, you know, all I needed in a way, was someone who had visited an exhibition of photographs and had suggested that maybe, you know, if the maker of the photographs knew that the photograph was going to fade over the duration of the exhibition, if they were upfront about it, then why not? You know, mm-hmm. then just say that's what it is. And I loved the idea that photography could have developed differently than it did, where there was this sort of obsession with permanence.
Right.
And I loved the idea that it might, you know, have a timestamp, right?
Yeah.
This is a 10-minute photograph. This is a 1-year photograph.
Right. Well, so interesting. Like, I was taken by the whole idea of the fading committee. I know I mentioned that to you in some of our correspondence, but even like the idea, like the name, the fading committee, you know, obviously like this kind of official sort of group, but the choice of the word fading as opposed to like the permanence committee, right? Like that to me even speaks to this sort of, you know, like they're leaning into this idea of, yeah, maybe it's a challenge that this is happening, but it's just like, I think just like that, the naming of the group tells us a little bit more about sort of what they were struggling with or grappling with at that time.
Well, and I should clarify that the fading committee, I mean, yes, the name is so evocative, right? It's mm-hmm. like irresistible.
Could be a good band name, like
right,
the fading committee.
Right. They were definitely interested in permanence. They were not kind of interested in this idea that I have suggested that maybe they could have gone a different way. They were definitely interested in keeping photographs stable and fixed. And it was someone who was later, you know, sort of separate, who floated that idea that perhaps it would be acceptable if people were upfront about the instability of their photographic work, that would be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely for the members of the fading committee, they were on board with permanence.
Yeah. In the book, you do, you discuss multiple artists or multiple examples of contemporary artists that are actually like it's part of their process to know that what they're creating is ephemeral, whether it's a photograph that's in an envelope and then once it's taken out and then it's exposed to light, it immediately starts to degrade, or hanging images in a show that with the intention of them fading. And to me, clearly from a 2024 perspective and having been educated in, you know, like contemporary art movements, that to me seems like clearly a conceptual approach that you're dealing with this, with these issues of impermanence and making the art a statement about that. But if we go back to that sort of the dissenting voices that may have existed back in, you know, the 1800s, when they were dealing with trying to make things permanent, I'm just trying to imagine like that dissenting voice of, to me, that's like a very contemporary modern thought to say, well, what if the point is that it fades away? But is there evidence that there were people thinking that way and that they were embracing that? You know, maybe they were more forward thinking about it.
I mean, not very much.
Yeah.
Really, it is predominantly a push towards getting photographs to, you know, sort of stay put, right? To get the image to stay where it is in a way that you can, you know, come back to again and again and again. But it was a challenge to deal with that, and to, you know, certainly in the space of exhibition, but also in the space of value, financial value, how we think about some of these challenges now. And to come back to the contemporary period, I mean, this, you know, again, that's sort of more my sweet spot, the conceptual origins of thinking through, oh, you know, this would be an interesting provocation at this point in whether it's the 20th century, late 20th century, the early 21st century, thinking through a much more sort of deliberately provocative approach to photography. And that's, you know, the area where I started. And it was thinking through, you know, how new is this really, that led me, you know, back to the period of invention. And then
And it also seems like, and I'm trying to make some sort of correlations between, clearly, you just mentioned like the commercial value of a print or a photograph at that time, like that's, you know, it's going to affect the value if it's, you know, it's more important that it's a permanent piece, right? So you've got financial or economic sort of parameters placed on the work. Also, it seems to me maybe that, and maybe this is in the larger sort of context of the Industrial Revolution, or just like this idea of that it's a technology, therefore it's got to be perfected. And the definition of perfection, by and large, was that it was going to be permanent. And if it wasn't permanent, then it was, it's almost like there, the progress needs to happen. And part of what defines that progress or success is the fact that it's permanent, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a dominant narrative. And I guess I got really interested in the sort of hidden or shadow narrative, the shadow history of all the failures, right? And how, even now, I just use the word failure, right? That those were times when the image was lost or wasn't permanent or faded over time, whether we're talking about color photography or, you know, salt paper prints or, you know, even digital images today, you know, sort of trying to back away from that somewhat automatic assumption that that's inherently not what we want. And, you know, sort of taking seriously this question about value and how we did get to all of these places of commercial value, of exhibition value, of aesthetic value, and then personal value, right? And I think a lot of, you know, my thinking around the idea, these ideas, comes from knowing that my own relationship to photographs is personal, right? And the connections that I have to particular images, it matters less if they last forever than the impact that maybe they had in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk a little bit about, so you are mentioning sort of, you know, curatorial challenges that come along with this, you know, the instability of these early images. And one of the things in the book that I think I probably was aware of, but really didn't give a lot of thought to, was sort of like the state of the original version of the famous courtyard photo by Niepce. Is that, and I always butcher that last name, so please correct me if I'm wrong. And you talk about that, and then there's a couple of things about that that I gave a lot of thought to. And the first is that the original, most people know a sort of a doctored reproduction or an enhanced reproduction of that image. And even that, when you see it in photo history books, you know, it's soft, there's contrast to it, but it's not, it's far from what we would consider like a pristine image. But even that is a cleaned up version of what the original actually looks like. And you describe, I believe it's like a tar based emulsion, is that right?
Yeah, it's actually bitumen of Judea, which is essentially tar. And this was one of the early photographic processes that didn't really stick, right? I mean, there are actually contemporary practitioners who are still using that process, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
They've revived it, I suppose. And so, right, that view out the window at Le Gras, right? That's the image we're talking about. It's on the cover of the book. The relationship of that object to the reproduction of the image on the object is a fascinating one. And, you know, other photo historians have also told this story, but I'm happy to share it here in the context of this book. So that image is in every photo history textbook. It's, you know, sort of the earliest extant, earliest still lasting photograph, right, in the history of photography, very famously. And it lives at the University of Texas at Austin. And, you know, if you are able to go visit it, it's quite extraordinary. They have a whole sort of viewing environment for it. It's protected, it's encased, it's a metal object with some dimension. It's quite beautiful in its own way, but the reproduction that they made of it when in those early photo history books was a black and white photograph that was then enhanced with watercolor to make it reproduce in a way that suggested something about the original object. And that, even though the object has since been re-photographed in a way that is much more accurate to its nature as an object, the earlier reproductions sort of persist in people's imagination. And I think that's fascinating, right? This sort of idea we have about what early photography is not necessarily accurate. And certainly there are a couple instances where those origins, you know, kind of made me feel like, oh, this the whole ground of everything that I've learned is a little bit shaky here. We're
right. I had the same reaction. I
was like, questionable all of a sudden. But also it makes sense in terms of, you know, all of these sort of fascinating, somewhat more conceptual or theoretical or philosophical questions about the medium, about the object and its reproduction, about its value, you know, all of these kinds of questions that have persisted for, you know, many decades, much longer than that, have been there sort of all along, which is one of the great things about this medium.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also struck me that, again, and like you just described, when I really sat and thought about it, I was like, wow, the whole foundation of everything that we've sort of like, that has grown from that image is, it's not like it was all a lie, but you know, in some ways it's like you have a different version of the history. And that was based on someone manipulating the original. And then that just sort of being then, okay, now this is the version that everyone is going to kind of run with. But you know, the other thing that I thought about after kind of considering that is, you know, instability of the components of photography never really went away. You know, like the, you know, different film substrates, or, you know, I mean, even like motion picture film that was highly flammable.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah. So, you know, the idea, I think that, and this is one of the really valuable things about your book, is that it forces you to reconsider, like, you know, like I said at the onset, like, okay, well, we've achieved this sort of like moment where everything's stable and it's a fixed image. And like, it's just this sort of clear progress from that point on. But the entire history of photography is just like one version of another of these sort of like, you know, the instability, whether it's intentional, which we'll talk about, but also just the fact that you're dealing with chemicals and variables that are so unique to even like the individual process. I mean, like if I don't fix my film properly, you know, I might get some good images, but then like go back to that film in 5 years, right? And then what's it going to look like?
I mean, there are endless ways for different photographic processes to be vulnerable and to be unstable. And exactly that, the persistence of that over time and still now, right? I mean, you were talking about chemicals, but in a digital era, but photographic images are still deeply unstable and subject to, you know, image loss, image degradation, you know, hard drive failure, all kinds of things.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. You made mention in the book this correlation between sort of like okay, if I go to how you described, to go to Texas to see that original version of the photograph in a specially created viewing environment. And it's like, forget exactly how you describe this, but it's like, okay, it's like it's being summoned to the viewer in a certain way. The digital, in the same way, is that there are these ones and zeros that don't really exist as something tangible until you have to summon that image up on a screen, right? There's a continuum in that, exactly what you're talking about, right from the beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the idea of summoning a photograph, right? Because there are so many photographs, of course, in the history of photography that really are unique. They're one of a kind, and you're only going to see them in one place. And that also is a sort of little bit of an illusion in terms of the narrative around photography, is, you know, this idea of an endlessly reproducible medium. Yes. So thinking about what the factors are and what the context is around that kind of summoning or evoking what that image or object is. And I am fascinated with that, just the sort of perpetual strangeness, honestly, with thinking through that idea of summoning an image on a device, on a screen, and sort of considering, well, where was it before that, right? Mm-hmm. And where did it go when I turn my phone off? And, you know, that's a kind of abstraction that I think we don't think through that often, but it is odd.
Yeah, it's odd, but having been educated pre-digital and, you know, having spent, you know, countless hours in a dark room and then storing prints, or just still like, I make a practice of printing, actually having like hard copies of images that I make. And there's clearly, there's a lifespan to those. But to me, that idea of, well, at least I have a print of it, so if the hard drive fries, or if, you know, my studio floods or whatever, that's my, and maybe it's just a generational thing where like, oh, well, I need to have a like a real backup of something, evidence of that photo. Yet, and I know this is something that has been discussed as far as sort of like, you know, new technology or social media apps or whatever, where that the current young generation doesn't necessarily think of, I mean, maybe in a retro way, they, you know, go back and value that. But the idea of like a Instagram story that disappears after 24 hours, or a Snapchat that's like, there's no physical evidence of those images, or even the fact that we used to have photo albums in the house, right? And, you know, everyone's photo album is like, oh, let me, you know, scroll through my camera roll to show you pictures. There seems to be, in some ways, there's been a shift of like value of an actual tangible photograph.
Maybe not though. Yeah. I think, I mean, one thing that, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the sort of like, it is a couple times I wasn't sure which you were referring to as the backup, like was the print the backup or was the digital version the backup? And I think both are, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, the fact that sometimes it's a little unclear which is more stable, you know, which is quote unquote better to have as a backup. It's not entirely evident. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that there's a way that prints, you know, absolutely retain currency. And even, you know, maybe more now in the last 5 or 7 years than 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that sort of recognition, right, that those prints have, they operate in a different way. They engage our senses in a different way, you know, and that's really clear. But that question about the backup, right? I mean, in the accessibility of digital images is, you know, sort of, I think, a little bit under thought through, right? Mm-hmm. So in the way that, you know, like floppy disks or something, right? Like that's those, whatever was on those, you know, it's good luck, right? Like
no one's going to be able to
read. No one's going back to find those.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I mean, just you were talking about scrolling. It's just as hard to find things scrolling, right? Like if you refresh your feed, you know, and you don't know where you saw the thing, it's also essentially in a functional way kind of gone.
Yeah.
So that to me is a kind of fascinating that it seems like things are, you know, sort of endlessly searchable and findable and taggable and sortable in a digital realm. But I also feel like I lose track of things all the time that I see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, online. Absolutely. Absolutely. Or even things that I think I have on my phone, which like maybe I do and I just can't find it, or like I was sure I had it. But there's this I think if you had a floppy disk of a photo, like good luck being able to retrieve that. And that I've had numerous different, you know, hard drives of old images that after like 4 years, when I transfer everything onto a new hard drive and hope that, you know, everything copies over, and then, you know, if there is a power surge and then it's all gone, you know, I think just psychologically, there's sort of like, okay, well, I have to accept that, even though, you know, like you're describing, well, if I have a print of, you know, the house burns down, then the print's gone, or the chemicals that they were using for, you know, to print that day, you know, maybe it's not as permanent as we think. Or, and this is something that I really like find fascinating, is that now, you know, I mean, there's this an aesthetic of faded photographs, or that they're, you know, like apps that replicate different color shifts, or things that, you know, or it's like a digital manipulation to mimic the degradation of an analog print. So it's this interesting sort of play between permanence and impermanence. Something that doesn't exist, you know, I mean, I don't like to say that a digital photograph doesn't exist, because it does exist.
Yeah.
But like, I just, it's this sort of this back and forth between these poles of permanence and impermanence. And to go circle back, it seems like that's been part of the conversation, or part, even if it hasn't been spoken, has been part of the medium from very, you know, the earliest days.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly that. It's not that we should feel so bad that photographs disappear, or that we should try so desperately to keep photographs to exist forever, but that both have always been true, right? That the medium is both of those things. And there's a lot more room, I think, to kind of think through that aspect of impermanence.
Yeah, I want to jump in a little bit. Let's talk about some of the examples that you have in the book of contemporary artists who are working in the impermanence or ephemerality of the medium as a key component to their work. Because I think that, and I alluded to it a little earlier, like to me, that's a contemporary thought, like a contemporary you know, layer to this discussion. And, you know, I was imagining that there was some sort of like renegade artist in, you know, 1850 who was in the same way that some of the examples that you used for 20th century or 21st century artists are doing. That whole idea of creating with a worked in obsolescence, really, I think it's just really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of area that you cover in the book?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that is, I think, really helpful is to sort of shift from thinking about photographs to the photographic. And something that is photographic is much more sort of expansive in its possibility, especially, you know, for thinking about durational photographs or the idea of a live photograph. And that was something that I got quite taken by, was the idea of a photographic event or a live photograph, or a way that a photographic practice or a presentation really foregrounded this idea, not of a print, right? Which you would then sort of have that tension of wanting it to last, but the idea of foregrounding instead that instability, that notion of a live event. So I think one of the first photographers I talk about is Phil Chang, who's based here in Los Angeles. And he makes photographs that are, you know, it's hard to even describe them without getting into the kind of the rhetoric of the medium that are imperfectly fixed, right? But perfectly, perfectly for what he wants.
Sure.
Which is, you know, to have them change over the course of a period of hours, a period of days, and for viewers to have a chance either to see that change, you know, sort of before their eyes, which is something that absolutely is one of those things I was talking about with rereading that 19th century material of, you know, sort of finding the language to describe the change as it's happening, as you're watching it, and sort of the thrill of that is something that, you know, I think Phil and his work is interested in having be a contemporary experience. And then, you know, there's this challenge of, well, then what, right? Because we do have this whole world of holding on to photographic prints and that the object is so valuable, right? Or matters so much. So then what do you do with the photographic print that after it's, you know, it's been sort of like, quote unquote, used up or, you know, has become darkened over the passage of time? So that those propositions that Phil Chang is making in his series, I think, are quite fascinating. But then there are other projects, you know, I wrote about the artist Kessels, who was also based in Los Angeles they're in New York now, but has a series of photographic sort of performances where the experience of the viewer is in a totally darkened room where there's a flash of light. And so the flash of the light is the strobe, the flash of a camera, but you're sort of witnessing this performance of exertion in the creation of, in the case of these performances, a sculpture, like a sculpture out of clay, and having those sort of visceral experiences as a viewer of the momentary flash of that moment, and then having it sort of live on in your memory or in, you know, a non-captured, non-photographically captured way from the perspective of the viewer. That is another way of thinking about the kind of live event of a photograph. And then Kessels does make, there are prints of those performances that exist, but I think they're arguably, you know, it's much more like the relationship of a photograph to a performance art piece than to...
Those examples that you just shared, to me, it's like, okay, from a performance art standpoint or a conceptual art standpoint, like, here's the idea, here's what's going to happen. The permanent documentation of it, to me, is almost like, I mean, it's like any performance art, it's an important documentation of the process. You know, the idea, it's undermining sort of like the perceived value of the photograph, right? Like,
although the difference I would say with Kessels' project is that the performance is only enabled by the photographic event, right? So it's not as if it's sort of purely or only documentation of a performance. It's integrally interwoven into the experience of the event, right? There is no without the photographic.
Yeah.
So it's different, but also, you know, just the sort of framing of like, oh, this is conceptual and that's performance art and this is photographic, right? I mean, one of the things that I think is worth kind of, you know, pushing on is the degree to which all of those areas have been really interwoven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's historians or college art departments or museum departments that have these separations that are useful for how we construct and divide our histories and stories that we tell. But there are all kinds, of course, of, you know, interweavings all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also, you know, to that list of who applies like certain definitions or criteria to what the work, how, what the work actually is, then you take into account, the marketplace, or, you know, is someone going to invest money in a piece that they know is impermanent, as opposed to, you know, like an art collector or a museum, where those things clearly become, you know, an important part of the conversation. But then also, like, you know, one of the things that you point out in your book is that, you know, like the special handling involved in even the earliest photographs that need temperature control, humidity control, can't be exposed to light for, or certain kinds of light for an extended amount of time. The fragility of even things that are certainly more permanent than some of these contemporary examples you're giving. I think that's another thing. It's like, so even if I pin something on the wall here, it's like, okay, at 2 o'clock every day, the sun's going to come in and hit that photo. And eventually it's going to degrade that image.
Maybe that's interesting.
It is interesting. It is interesting. That's what got me excited about the book, is that like, for me personally, that is interesting, because the old, you know, and I have examples hanging around my studio here where, you know, it's like, what happens when something is bleached or burned or, you know, or faded or, you know, left. I know artists who are like burying their film or, you know, leaving prints underground or those kinds of ideas where challenging that whole notion of and this is a huge sort of metaphysical kind of thought, but like, nothing's permanent.
Right. Nothing's permanent. And some of the projects, which I want to circle back to in just a second, but I do think it's, you know, I mean, people support all kinds of impermanent things. People love impermanence when it comes to music and conversation and theater and festivals, right? And there's big money behind those things. And in a way, like, I sort of feel like turning it around is really useful. Like, it's sort of a shame that photography hasn't been allowed to be that in some ways, right? I see it as limiting, right? Mm-hmm. That there's a fixed, you know, to use the language of photography, overly kind of fixed notion of what the possibilities are. And again, it's the sort of idea of excitement of what else is possible and what other ways to engage with this medium are there that have just kind of either flown under the radar or haven't been thought of as interesting or engaging or exciting, like watching the photograph, you know, pinned up to your window fade. Like, maybe that's interesting. But yes, yeah, so the idea of long-term or, you know, sort of existential impermanence, some of the artists that I talk about do have this sort of engagement with sort of longer or deeper time and are thinking through when the earth ends, what about photographs, right? Like, which on the one hand, like, who cares, right? But as a sort of thought question, right, could photographs outlive the rest of us, and what are the sort of archaeological ruins of the future, what lasts, and how as humans do we want something to last, which is also very kind of human wish or desire to, you know, to sort of live on, even, you know, even against the knowledge, right? That ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, it's like this existential, you know, quandary, I guess, that where you're thinking about, like I said, nothing ultimately is permanent, or like just playing with that idea from an artistic standpoint. You know, one could think, well, you know, a sculpture carved from marble may last longer than a photograph printed and then stuck on the wall, but both those things will degrade eventually, or you know, succumb to external forces.
Yeah, and those forces might be environmental, you know, or they might be human, right?
Like, yeah,
the effects of war are profound on loss of cultural artifacts. You know, we see that all the time. So that's, you know, I mean, one of the things that I did sort of early on in thinking through these questions was sort of make lists of all the ways that photographs could disappear, or, you know, by extension, cultural objects can disappear. And a lot of them are environmental and have to do, you know, simply with the passage of time. But a lot of it is, you know, human destruction.
Right. So the artist, and you'll have to refresh my memory, who placed images on, I think it was like a space satellite or...
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that project, because that to me lends itself to, like, connects to what we were just talking about. So the idea of images that end up in space, who knows who, what, if anything, if they'll ever be seen again. But that, I mean, to me, that idea is really rooted in that whole sort of idea of, well, the images existed. They still exist. No one's there to see it. You know, if the tree falls in the forest and no one takes a picture of it, did it really fall? I mean, can we talk about that project? Because in a lot of ways, I was just like trying to imagine, like, I want to preface this by saying that I not necessarily believe that there's like aliens who are going to come across this, but they might. But like that they would even like know like how to read it or visually assess what this is. And it's a fascinating idea on so many levels. Can you just tell me a little bit about the artist in that project?
Yeah, that was I was sort of describing that a little bit, but I didn't use the artist's name, which is Trevor Paglen. And I mean, he's a great thinker when it comes to, well, lots of things, but certainly this question of kind of deep time in photography and what it means to create an archival image and how, in a way, that term kind of, once you get to the sort of most ultimately archivable image, it's also functionally useless, mm-hmm. right? Which is another one of these tensions that I'm sort of consistently interested in the book, is the way that the efforts to preserve something make it completely inaccessible. So yeah, he made a selection of, it's called the Last Picture Project. And, you know, now I'm forgetting the number of images it is, but you know, and they're actually quite banal images, right? They're not the sort of, you know, certainly the most stereotypical images you would think of as to sort of record humanity. But those images ended up being etched onto a chip that was placed on a satellite that is in perpetual orbit. So, you know, this is the sort of idea of the space junk, right? The satellites in orbit, that whether they're news satellites or information satellites, once they're in that orbit, it doesn't matter what happens on Earth, right? If we stop receiving the signals, if Earth is destroyed, the satellites keep on going. So they outlast, they persist. So, I mean, right, the odds of some other life form finding that particular satellite that these images are etched onto out of the sea of satellites up there, and then, you know, sort of decoding the images from the code that they're etched into feels remote.
Sure,
but
sure.
As a kind of provocation or a thought question of what it means to, you know, sort of preserve something from the most destructive forces that humanity would not survive, you know, those images survive and then what? So yeah, that's, I agree, a fascinating project.
Yeah. And I think it relates to, like, you can have a little time capsule, right? Where you kind of like put things in a case and then bury it in the yard, and maybe you mark it, and then in 50 years you dig it up or whatever, or maybe you slip something in the crawl space of a house that no one, you know, discovers until years later, or the idea of you can etch something in the sand on the side of the ocean, and then when the tide comes up, it's gone, right? I mean, there's all of these different sort of, like, you call it a provocation, you know, maybe larger or smaller, but, like, you know, just challenging this sort of like relentless passage of time and the acceptance of that everything's impermanent.
Like, there's another artist who's, this is not a photographic project, Katie Paterson, who has this thing called the Future Library, and she commissions contemporary writers to write, you know, they could write a novel or a poem or a short story, and it then goes into under lock and key essentially for 100 years. So no one who's alive now will be able to read what this, you know, oftentimes very prominent author has written, you know, and it's, I think time capsules are, you know, sort of inherently optimistic, of course, mm-hmm. because you're imagining that there'll be a future reader. But I think with some of these projects, there's also, you know, a kind of impulse to have people want humanity to persist, right? In the face of you know, environmental crises, all of the challenges that we're facing, you know, to sort of act as a bit of a, not that they're going to save humanity on their own or save the earth on their own, but, you know, act as a, that's 100 years out. That's a little bit more manageable amount of time to kind of wrap your head around that. What's the world going to look like when those books are read? And yeah. I think that can be a kind of productive space to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just used like the way you described it, it's an act of hope, or that, mm-hmm. that, you know, there, someone will be around to read it, or, and then, you know, maybe the flip side of that, not hopeless that, you know, but just the recognition that, or the acceptance to a certain degree, I guess, that not everything will be retrievable, or not everything should be, you know, like, you know, you talked earlier about, you know, seeing a live musical performance, or, you know, any kind of, you know, performance where you're there may be recorded, or, but you're there, you experience it, or a conversation, or a great meal, you know, you're making, like, you know, a chef will make something, it's presented, you eat it, it's gone, right?
Yeah, so, there's lots of ways that we enjoy and value ephemeral, fleeting experiences, and you and wouldn't want those to last forever, right? Part of the joy and part of the sort of wonder of them is that they're brief, yeah. And they do, you know, they live in your memory, and that's what, as it should be. Right. So I guess I want that for photographs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this might be a good place to wrap things up. Kate Palmer Albers, thank you so much for joining me. I really was thrilled that you agreed to join me today. And the book is fantastic. I'm recommending it to a bunch of my high thinking photo friends. So
thanks so much.
Grapple with these bigger issues. It's just, but it's a treasure, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
So there you go, folks. My conversation with Kate Palmer Albers. Again, she is the author of a book called The Night Albums, Visibility and the Ephemeral Photograph. Really worth getting your hands on and reading if you really want to jump into this topic further. I will, of course, leave a link for the book and where you can find it, and also more information about Kate and her work. I really found this whole idea really shifted my idea of not only the history of photography, but also just looking at the world today and how digital photography or social media images are often just easily digested and then just as easily disposed of. And I think that goes into this whole idea of the history of photography being based on images that were also not as permanent as one would have assumed. And so really interesting also to think about making work with the knowledge of the fact that most people won't see it, or your work won't last for one reason or another. And if you really want to get into an existential conversation, just thinking about the fact that anything that humans may create has an expiration date for sure. So really intriguing conversation today with Kate, and I really was grateful that she took time to join me. So that's it for today's episode. Of course, you can find information about all my episodes at my website, which is righteyedominantpodcast.com. Of course, if you scroll all the way down to the bottom of the episode list, you'll also find a place where you could send me questions or comments. I always love to hear from listeners. Also, if you use Instagram, I do have an Instagram page, Right Eye Dominant Podcast, where I share images and other information for each episode. And then lastly, if you could, leave me a rating or review on whatever platform you find your podcasts. So that's going to do it for this episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time,
Stay well.
This podcast has been a production of RightEyeDominant.art. The sounds and music from this episode are courtesy of The Connet Project and Yazar.